Well, welcome everyone. I'm Gail Brown. It's great to see you all. I know many of you were at the reading last night, which was just, I don't know what, amazing. It was mesmerizing. It was a wonderful experience. And we're happy to have Dan back with us this afternoon to sort of continue the conversation we started last night about his work and poetry in general. Many of you know, if you weren't in the audience last night, you would not have heard this part of the introduction, that Dan was one of our Next Word in Poetry, one of our first, I think, readers in that series in 2004. And since that time, he's gone on to publish a number of other books of poetry, Mulberry. I knew I had these memorized, Dan. I'm sorry. This Nest, Swift, and Passerine, beautiful title. And The Whaler's Dictionary, which is a book of prose. Yes, Spell. I think you had just published Spell when you came here.
Yeah, that's
so
right.
Many, many books of poetry for us to enjoy and think about and maybe talk about some today. So I'm just going to open this up to questions. Feel free to ask whatever you like. We'll go for about an hour. Okay. Speak into the mic when you ask the question. Yeah, that helps. Who wants to start?
Well, one of the pleasures, Dan, in your poetry for me is the variety of shapes the poems take on the page. Thumbing through your most recent book, we see stanzas and paragraphs and columns and things that I wouldn't know what to name, to be honest. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if you can talk about how you arrive at the shape of the poem on the page, or the shapes, I should say.
It became in some ways a real issue for me in a way that I had to have some sort of sense of order about the page in my third book, Mulberry, which when I had originally conceived of it, and this will you'll see how practical the idea was a giant scroll that was composed in various columns. And, of course, at some point I realized that, one couldn't have a page that had these three interpenetrating columns and one could see all these connections. And so I had to sort of begin to think about certain quadrants of the page as occupying a different sort of thinking. In that book, there's running through the entire book a sort of central column. Justified on the left-hand side, that is a sort of confessional voice in many ways that seeks ways not to come to closure, essentially. And it's the sort of central axis around the whole poem. And the left-hand column are poems dealing most typically with early American history, poems that are actually centered dealing with aesthetics and the erotic, and these poems that would be on the right dealing often with philosophy and theology. And then the second half of that book takes all the lines from those three columns and undoes them and restitches them into other poems. You can see it's all mixed in different ways, paying attention to where their original column space was. And so that book, when I turned to working on This Nest, Swift, Passerine, I had a way of intuitively thinking about different parts of the page offering a different kind of thinking. So if you trace your way through there, you'll notice that the poems that are all centered in a way have a certain kind of meditative quality, often a kind of ecstatic meditative quality, that things that are absolutely fragmentary are typically going to be on the right-hand side. Things of more lyric coherency in terms of like an actual individual poem will be on the left. But that book gets much more complicated in its visual, formal life. By the time you get to the third section, there's a page that's dealing with all sorts of issues of reflection and doubleness and ways in which two column poems will be interacting with one another, the right-hand column somehow composing itself by listening in echo to the sounds of the other. And so there's all different kinds of tensions in a way. the architect Buckminster Fuller, he had this word for a structure's integrity, which he called its tensegrity, a combination of tension and integrity together. And in many ways, I've come to think of that as a sort of poetic formal principle, that one has to find the right tensegrity for a given poem. When you're operating in a broader field of a page, you know, a tensegrity of the page, where different modes of consideration can somehow bring themselves into a kind of harmony, essentially.
Thank you.
I was remembering how last night you talked about how your writing and your reading are so intertwined, and I was curious, was there ever a time for you as a writer when that was not the case? You know, perhaps when you were very young or when you started, did you ever write poems that were not interacting with texts? I know maybe it's difficult to admit it, but I'm really curious, you know, how that might have happened, or did it just happen all at once, like you started writing because of reading? And
well, that's a great question. I think I did start writing because of reading, but I didn't know that was the case, and so I wrote really awful poems. I was a teenager, so. But the moment that in some ways is a pivotal moment was being a junior in high school. I had a really extraordinary English teacher to whom I owe a tremendous amount. And well, there were two moments. One, I had sort of fancied myself a poet, you know. I thought that about myself when I had no right to do so. And we had an assignment to read a Shakespeare sonnet, and we were to get up with our group. Of course, I took charge of this group because I was a poet, and I gave this interpretation of that time of year thou mayest in me behold, you know, Shakespeare, forgive me. And I was wrong in the most arrogant, awful sort of way. And my teacher simply said, you know, you're wrong. And I thought, I am wrong. I have no idea what I'm talking about. And so there was this kind of humiliation publicly for which I was very, very grateful. And then later on, I had started seeing the woman who is my wife. We've dated since high school, which, you know, was, of course, this very intense thing. And we were in that class together. And we were reading John Donne's A Valediction Forbidding Mourning. And she, our teacher, went through this poem that, you know, makes one realize that whatever figurative language is, it's not abstract, you know. Like, it seems abstract to us because we seldom tax our mind in a way that recognizes figurative precision. And all of a sudden I felt it, you know. I felt this poem. I felt why it was being written. I saw how it worked. I saw, you know, this woman who would be my wife sitting four seats in front of me. And I guess for the first time in my life I thought it can be done, you know. Like, someone can write a poem. There can be such a thing as a poem. And I think I've always since then written into that realization, you know, which isn't about me per se at all. It's about finding a way to participate in this thing that is kind of inevitably and impossibly and continually possible, that it can be expressed, you know. I still can't get over it.
Following up on, I was also thinking a lot about this reading-writing interaction, and for example, earlier in the week when I was reading some of your poems and then started writing, I found myself writing my own poems about nesting, and I've been thinking about nesting all week, and so I'm wondering how you, and that was kind of accidental based on what I had read. So I'm wondering how you choose what you read, or if you read what you kind of want to write about more or learn about more, or just in general, if you're reading everything at all times and it comes out.
Well, I'm never reading everything at all times. There's a number of things, and I mean, I'm very interested in what you said before you actually asked a question, just that notion of influence that you're talking about from reading, which is a thing that, you know, a lot of us have been taught to avoid or feel, you know, an anxiety about, to give the phrase. And I've always thought of influence as the most important thing one can expose oneself to, that reading is this grand experiment in being influenced. And it's very hard to be honestly influenced and let another's voice very fundamentally into one's own feels to me like a very important thing. As to how I choose what I read, I sort of, you know, all these books, they're also books that, if you learn to see it in a certain way, are these repositories of their own influences, you know. Nothing is coming in and out of itself. And so, you know, with books that I love, I tend to read the books that made those books possible. So when I read Emerson, I worry about Montaigne, and I read Montaigne, and because I read Montaigne, I read Plutarch, and there's this... You know, the thing that is so exciting to me at some level about being involved in literature, and certainly reading is in some ways the primary involvement, is that every one of these great masterpieces, if you press on it in the right way, it links to all these astonishing places. And I just follow the things I love. I love the things those love, and that's how I do it. It's purely chosen by bliss. I have no system at all. I'm absolutely irresponsible as a scholar, because I'm not one. I'm a poet.
See if I can form this. I was wondering if you'd be willing to talk about the new work that you read last night. We were talking about, over the span of your books, the glass being on the textual and going more and more profound, deeper and deeper, and that suddenly it seemed to me that you'd reached the bodily and that it was a portal, and it seemed like you were in new territory. And does that make sense to you, or can you speak about your new work or where how it might be?
Yeah, I mean, I can try to speak about my new work. Well, one of the things that I think has opened up is a real sense of atavism, of ancestry, of tradition in a very radical sense, one that is more palpable and tangible than simply writing a poem that has as its primary thinking another text. I've become concerned with these stories that are always underneath texts. And part of, I suppose, what is most bodily is that I've been given over to various forms of repetition, you know, the sensing of needing to stay and repeat and vary a single line until it in some ways has revealed every capacity for its thinking that I'm capable of paying attention to. At the same time, you know, I have this daughter that I didn't have when I was writing any of those books about other books. And there's something about watching her come into language, about the mistakes that are these wondrous mistakes that she makes in language of thinking about any given word as often a type of knowledge that begins in mistake and ends because of that mistake in a sort of memory, in a sort of remembrance of what is correct. And one of the things that's going on is trying to find a way to replicate in a poem through repetition that process of realization turning into a mistaken realization and then reorienting itself back into memory of paying attention to the world in a way that I couldn't have done without refrain, in a sense. There's also just a music, a rhythm. I'm more given to meter than I used to be, and the bodily nature of that music in a poem is more important to me. Like, I want, you know, someday for my daughter to come to a reading and hear something that she doesn't understand that might still be beautiful to her. And finding a way to manage that that's accessible in a way I often haven't been accessible in my previous work, that is more open, is more at hand, and yet is losing nothing of its rigor, hopefully, its thought. These things are very much on my mind.
So, Dan, you've been doing quite a, well, you've been teaching for a very long time, but right now you're at Iowa for this semester. That's a school that you, that's where you studied, that's where you got your MFA. What has it been like to go back to Iowa as a teacher?
I'm still sort of trying to figure that out. The thing that it makes me realize most is how deeply embedded memory is inside of location, you know, how tangible memory is when you return to a place you used to live, that I have all sorts of memories about, but they're memories that aren't physical. But when I'm walking around Iowa City, you know, I see these places. I remember being in them. I remember who used to live in these houses. And it gains a kind of mythological life at the same time that time in my life was incredibly intense, you know, filled with the turmoil of figuring out what my ambitions were, of struggling with ambition, of, you know, the awful hothouse of that time in a young writer's life. And it was filled with intensities for me. And so being back there and feeling that intensity in my students, of still recognizing its vestiges in myself, of wondering what is the most honest way to teach, the most helpful way to teach, and to realize that I'm not a student anymore, is just the most shocking thing, that there's this distance from where I was 10 years ago to where I am now, when to realize that, to realize that in these 10 years since I was a student to where I'm at now, that the devotion to the work I've tried to practice has come to something, that there's something to say to my students. That's shocking to me, actually.
My question is about how you walk the line between writing as a private thing and writing as a public thing. And I think you're in a position right now as a teacher but yet still close enough to the experience as a student. I feel like as students, a lot of times the work can be too personal or too much of focusing on your personal experience without remembering that it's also like a worldly experience, or how to speak to something much larger than yourself. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. Well, the primary thing, I mean, the primary way I think about that problem now is very different than it used to be. Where I think one of the primary crises of poetic language is that it's never private. I mean, there is no private language. There's always this language that is all of ours. And so whatever is involved in the poetic act, it's taking something that is interior, yes, but interior already in a language that then the poet risks putting outside of himself, putting outside of herself. So that the very nature, I think, of any kind of poetic expression, regardless of whether or not another person ever sees it, is that you're taking this profound risk of making a world that for you might be absolutely real as long as you don't utter it to yourself or anyone else, and making it available not for another person's belief so much as another person's doubt, of making it questionable, of making it foreign, which is to say that any time you write a poem, it might be too naive to simply think that when you say I in that poem, it is reducible to the I that is you. It becomes, of necessity, radically other. This is inside Rimbaud's sense that I am the other, which is a sense that predates his letter in which he says that. Poetry's awfulness is that it's always othering your most intimate self. But that's also a kind of, it's also its necessary beauty. It's, I think, deeply moral importance. I think more closer to what you're asking, how can you take that which is private, experiential most likely, and put it on the page in a way that it's okay for other people to see it? I don't have any good answer for that, you know. I guess because in the end, I think if it's on the page, it's not yours anymore. You're not your own on the page. And it sort of negates that problem. And I think where people get upset is when they value the poem as a part of themselves.
Can I ask another question?
I think so.
Okay. This is more about your work with your last one, The Whaler's Dictionary. I don't know if that's the last one I'm aware of. That seems more of a prose book than a poem, in like my interpretation of it. And I was wondering more about the editing process and you working with Milkweed, and how, whether you worked with the nonfiction or the poetry editor with that, and how that might go.
I should say that I am continually shocked and weirdly offended that book is always shelved in poetry. Because it's not a book of poems in my mind. It has a certain kind of poetic something, but it's odd that it's shelved in like Borders, which strangely enough carries it occasionally. You know, it's always in where an actual book of poems I would write, which they don't carry, would be. and it's there's just some ridiculous bias that a poet can't write things that aren't poems. Or it's weird in a way that, you know, that, and it's a weird book, but because it's weird, it must be poetry. And it's not. They're weird essays, weird meditational, devotional essays to a book I love that loves me back in complicated ways. It makes me keep having to write books about it. Milkweed is an extraordinary place. I feel more grateful than I know how to say to be with them. And I work directly with the head editor, Daniel Slager, who in an amazing act of editorial responsibility, proof edited that book himself and then hired another person to do it. I mean, I've never seen a press more devoted to making a book work, come out clean. It was astonishingly intense. I had to go through proofing it two times. And that book is insanely hard to edit and to proof because it's not linear in scope. It's all interconnected. I mean, writing it almost broke up my marriage because it was so complicated to kind of keep what originally had been over 130 essays that are interconnected, cross-referenced with one another in some kind of order. And feeling like I was walking around in this stupor really for 15 months trying to remember what connected to what, and having written so much that I didn't even know what was what. And so to end up with these astonishingly generous and yet precise readers who helped me to cut against the unnecessary lyricism of my own prose voice, but also that felt the shape of it, that kept me on track, that gave me an ability to keep all the interconnections livid and right, and would suggest ones that weren't there and would cross off the ones that, you know, probably weren't necessary. I owe them a tremendous, tremendous debt for not simply bringing the book out, but for making it better. I can't rave enough about Milkweed. And, you know, I had sent that book to some other places that had wanted to see it, actually. And no one would take it because they said it was too strange. One editor wrote back and said, "This is the kind of book that I would buy for myself and copies for my friends. And 20 years ago, you would have been able to get this published, but no one will take a risk on a book like this now." And then there's Milkweed.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking about last night. You talked about, this is kind of like on the side, but right before you read a poem, you talked about being in Chicago and seeing the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Jeff Koons balloon. And mm-hmm. I was like, I wanted to see if you could expand about, like, with that experience, because it's kind of, it's pretty intense to go, like, all the way back, the first artifact and now.
Yeah. I used to hate Jeff Koons' work. And a good friend of mine, who's an artist, loved Jeff Koons' work, a man named Alex Jovanovich, who made me begin to at least not dismiss it. And I was back to give a reading, actually, and the MCA had this giant Jeff Koons retrospective, the first thing of which when you go in is this, you know, his famous bunny rabbit mirror-like surface where you appear in it twice. You appear in its belly and then inverted in its head. And then I looked around and I noticed how many of his pieces are involved with always giving you a surface that is reflecting you back, and sometimes doing so in the most subtle of ways. I mean, well, you know, he has these quite deeply pornographic pictures that he does with his former porn star wife. And I think she's his former wife and a former star of pornography. Those are both former things. And there was a kind of older woman. She seemed like in her 70s, and there's a guard standing, is like behind a partition. And he said, "The question of the material behind this partition is questionable." And she was like, "Okay, thanks," and went in. And he looked at me, and he just looked at the ground. And I thought, isn't that weird? He won't tell me that there's objectionable things. And you would go around this corner, and there's these, you know, small billboard-sized pornographic photos. And what I realized about them is that they're shot from an angle where the two Koons and his wife, whose eyes are looking at you, can only see themselves as if I was a mirror reflecting them back, you know, that it's this angle that can only be seen if in some ways the viewer is a mirror to what's going on. And that made something click in me, this way in which whatever Kunz is about, part of what he's about is the absolute beauty and mercilessness of reflective surfaces, of always putting ourselves in a position where we're witnessing ourselves think about a thing that in its perfection, and the pornographic pictures are in their ways absolutely perfect, offer us no place to rest secure in finding a difference that makes of our thinking a genuine thinking. It's unsettling. You never find flaw. You never find error. You never find the difference that the categorical mind needs in order to kind of come to a certainty of analysis, of judgment. And that became troubling in a very beautiful way, or beautiful in a very troubling way to me. And then, you know, 3 hours later, I'm at this other museum where there's these cylindrical scrolls, which is also in that poem, where you roll it across mud and a woman is braiding and unbraiding her hair to infinity, if there's material enough, where there's cuneiform written in these little pieces of mud, and this Dead Sea Scroll that is torn, mangled, and this translation that says, to study circumcises the heart. It calms the blood. Many words are missing. If not, you know, there's fire in the veins. Many words are missing. Anger, anger. And it startled me that thought of study, of reading as a strange sort of circumcision in a way, that limits us. And I think that's true and a powerful idea in many ways, that that the very first act of creativity isn't expansiveness, but a reduction, a compression that makes a space for the nothingness in which one begins to do one's work. And that, for me, you know, in ways that we've all talked about in a variety of ways, you know, that reading is this thing that creates that space in me. It does, in some ways, you know, to use the language, circumcise the heart. And it was just dizzying that they fit together, that those museums, they didn't seem all that separate to me in a way.
So I am presuming about you that you're not just a reader, but that you are a rereader. And I'm wondering if you can talk a bit about the distinction, if there is one for you, between entering a text and re-entering a text, and if that has any correlation to your poems. Particularly, I'm thinking about Spell and Whaler's Dictionary, if those seem like progressive projects, or if they both embody a similar space that you enter into in relation to Moby Dick.
I have a certain problem with Moby Dick, of which Spell and the Whaler's Dictionary are indicative. In some ways, I wrote a Whaler's Dictionary because I feel that I had failed in a certain way with Spell, which is to say that I wanted to write poems about this book that is a mystery to me and a book I love. And I realized at some point that the book also, it had to be about itself. It had to become formally coherent to its own world. And so I started, you know, if you know that book, it moves away. It becomes about its own writing in a way. There's letters to these editors, and I felt like I needed to do that to learn something, because I was very young. I was writing that when I was at Iowa, actually, and not showing it to anyone. It was my secret rebellion against workshop. And I felt like I had betrayed, in not the right way, what it was I wanted to do, which was pay the utmost, fullest attention I could to this one work that still for me has in it every question I can ask about writing. I ask it because that book asks me to ask it. Rereading is, for me, you know, it's where actually reading begins. There's that line in Emerson's Experience where he says that it seems as if an impenetrable screen of purest sky has been pulled down behind us and before us. You will not remember, it seems to say, and you will not expect. And I feel like, in some ways, that's also a strange kind of reading advice, that to somehow reread, but to divorce yourself from the sense of knowing what's going on or your concern of plot, frees you in a way to read what the book is really about. I think the great example of this is Proust, where, you know, part of the, I think, the deep work that In Search of Lost Time accomplishes over its thousands and thousands of pages is that it's so long that you forget in some ways what has gone before. And so when you go back to reread it, suddenly you're in the position that the narrator himself is in, where you have to somehow recognize that which you've already experienced with the uncanny sense that you haven't experienced it before. Suddenly your memory is taxed. You're in that position. And that is, I mean, that's really a maddening thought, that you read Proust the first time when you read it the second time, because then you're in the experience of memory that that book is actually about. And that also shocked me. Moby Dick is the same way. I mean, there are strange harmonies of how odd time behaves in Proust and in Moby Dick that make them strangely similar books in a way. But because Moby Dick is so deeply about the need of meaning, the need of answers, the impossibility of meaning, the impossibility of answers, that it's returning to the book in which supposedly you should have the answers for having read it, just as Ishmael should be able to say his own name after the experience that has removed him from his name, that suddenly the book then isn't this mystery, there's no tension, there's no plot, there's no reason to be reading it save to be experiencing it in a way that you cannot experience without turning to it again and again. And it's that moment where easier inclinations to read a book fall apart that I think what the book is reveals itself. You're included. Your memory's there. You have your own self to deal with in a weird kind of way as a character established in those pages. And real things happen then. Does that answer your question? Okay.
So you mentioned your secret rebellion against workshop and this manuscript you were writing, and I wondered if you could speak a little bit about kind of how you've, what that looks like as a teacher to be thinking about some ways in which how workshops are fraught, and like what are some ways that you've been able to turn that or, you know, rethink that as a teacher in considering what it's like as a student in a workshop?
Well, I was so down on workshop after my own graduate student life that I refused to teach them. I didn't teach one for 6 years, in part because I didn't find an honest, it didn't feel like there was an honest way to do it. And eventually I had to teach them, and I was reluctant to, and slowly over the years have found an approach that feels honest, even if it feels in a curious sort of way, given what a workshop is supposed to be, kind of useless. I go to rather great lengths to suggest that we're not here in this class, this workshop, to make each other's poems better. I have no interest in making a poem better. I don't care for good poems. I'm not interested in judging the poem. I don't care if anyone likes this poem or doesn't like this poem. All of that seems to me an abuse of a space of actual inquiry, because it places judgment in front of recognition. And so what we try to do is recognize what it is the poem is doing, what its, you know, genuine crisis in the deepest sense of that word is. You know, crisis's etymology being a point at which a disease either kills you or you survive it. Its etymology being the moment when a woman goes into labor, of finding this place, as Emerson would say, that is the necessity upon which beauty rests, and to talk about that necessity, to have a discussion about it, to talk about the poem as if it is the complex, strange, failed, awkward, intense, stunning, beautiful, brilliant, stupid, great, awful thing it is. And to have students value that conversation. And if you really have it, inevitably but accidentally, the poems get better, you know, because you've talked about what the poem actually is. And, you know, one of the things I worry about in workshop is that, and it goes back to the question that you asked in some ways, you know, it is a scary thing to write a poem and to show it to people who gather around a table to judge its quality. And one of the inevitable consequences of the falsity of that, you know, that breach of trust, and it is a breach of trust, is that people learn to hide. And they learn to hide in all sorts of ways. They learn to hide behind their cleverness, behind their intellect. They learn to hide behind bald-faced confession. They can too easily write poems whose heart is an unnecessary evasion. And so to open up a place where that doesn't have to happen, because we're going to think about it. We're not going to make it better. We're just going to talk. We're going to talk about the difficulty of the poem. That's what I try to do. And we start off not with each other's poems. You know, we read Heraclitus, we read Diogenes, we read the Homeric Hymn to Hermes, we read Hawthorne's The Artist of the Beautiful for next week. We read these things that make us realize that poetry isn't what's happening around this table for this 3-hour period at all. You know, we're participating in something larger than us, and we need to participate that in the most mindful way possible.
At least when I write poetry, and I kind of just started, but I feel like a lot of the time I at least attempt to incorporate the same desires of my fiction writing into my poetry writing, in that I try and develop characters or develop a common theme. And I'm just wondering how you attempt to do that when you write, and that if you've ever written fiction work before, and if those same desires can translate over and how they translate over.
I have recently, in the last 2 years or so, been experimenting with fiction. And it does feel like a very different art to me, devoted to different things, having, in some ways, very different sources, I guess, different kinds of consequences or causes. I feel like I'm stuttering because I don't really know how to articulate what I'm saying. You know, I think a poem contains a different kind of gravity, a different kind of inevitability than a piece of fiction does. Fiction often has to move from one point to another. It has to establish a kind of connection that adheres to the sort of logic by which we recognize how our own daily life moves from point A to point B. Poetry is not, I think, all that invested in A connecting to B. It has a very different kind of inevitability, one that somehow makes us recognize that our ability to make a linear record of any given day is also a trick of the mind, a habit of the mind, that were we to actually subscribe ourselves to the actual information, the actual experience that comes in on a day-to-day basis, there would be no way to function in the world. And poetry exacerbates that peripheral quality of the eye, that peripheral quality of the mind that allows things in that complicate our relation to our own life and the world because it complicates them. Fiction can also do this, but then that fiction's poetry in my mind. A poem's relation to its theme versus fiction's relation to its theme, that's a huge question, and it's a great one, and I don't think I'm smart enough to have an answer that's appropriate. I guess one of the things that one can't forget is that one of the gods that is the tutelary god of the poem is Hermes, and Hermes is a trickster. And as you know, the muses, when they come down from Olympus every morning, they sing a lie so it seems like the truth, and they sing the truth when they want to. Poetry's relation to our life is one that enjoys as much the disorder that it causes in the midst of order as it does in disorder creating order. It complicates things. It makes them difficult. It undoes boundaries. It undoes borders. It is, as Thoreau says in the journals, a more severe logic than the logician's logic. And it's more severe because it's merciless. It doesn't let you rest with what seems apparently at hand. It disorders and reorders. And I'm not sure fiction does that often in the same way. At least fiction doesn't need to. I might be really wrong about that, too, I should say.
Would you say that having focused so much on poetry, and this might be an obvious answer, but has that affected your foray into fiction writing? Like, do you see any sort of effect in the way that you write fiction now after having focused on poetry for so long?
Oh, yeah. I don't have any interest in plot, for instance, which will obviously make my fiction really enjoyable to read. It, you know, the one thing it did, and the fiction that, for fairy tales, for instance, you know, they all have a plot, but the deepest thinking that's occurring in a fairy tale, it's not happening in the plot. It's often happening in in images, and the way in which those images also gain a very curious kind of symbolic life. One of the things I think that poetry is a training in is the way in which an image isn't simply the evocation of a sensible data, you know, sight, hearing, taste, touch, smell, but that an image is in some ways a contained thinking, an entire thinking, an image that actually works. And not just a thinking. By thinking here, I also mean a feeling, you know. As thinking is also, as poetry knows, deeply perceptive at its core. And so one of the things that, when I'm working on fiction, that I pay attention to is not to construct a plot via a series of events, but through a reiteration and development of, per fairy tales, certain symbols, certain images that continue to develop and re-exert and reformulate a thinking that had been inherent at one point, but over the course of the development of the story, changes its nature. And in part, this is giving to things their symbolic life. If one wants to think about the symbol as that which is a many and a one at the same time, that is part of the trick of learning to think symbolically, which I think poetry is also a training in, is that one recognizes that the symbol has a subterranean life, that it's always exerting meaning in a way that is more complex and perhaps completely opposite to the surface that you're interpreting. It has this wholeness to it, and you get to see one side of that wholeness. So that Emerson, you know, he has this great definition of the mystic as one who has nailed the meaning of a symbol into one place, and the poet is the one who, or the artist is the one who refuses to nail that meaning down into place and stake everything on it, but to trust that somehow the symbol is a fluxional life. And fiction in ways that I think can be very, very powerful, can allow a real symbolic flourishing in certain images, a real development, a real changing over the course of time, so that you build into this place, as Moby Dick does, and with many of its primary symbols, that's sort of nauseating, that's overpowering, but that you can't explain, that resists your ability to define it. And that's what interests me. That's what poetry has taught me about writing fiction. Okay.
Well, I think, I guess, in a certain sense, every answer you've given maybe answers this question. But I've noticed that, you know, a term that you've mentioned both in talking about reading and writing and teaching that comes up is rigor. So I wanted to ask you, what is rigor?
Well, I guess it's just ceaselessness. It's not valuing what you've done, you know, it's doing what's next and refusing every excuse not to, which becomes increasingly hard. But I don't know. There's work to be done. And, you know, I want to be at work. And I want my students to be at work. I want to be at work. And I think that's rigor.
Dan, thank you so much. Let's give him a round of applause. Can we do that? Thanks for coming to Tucson. I know it's been a busy spring. We've loved having you here and hope to see you again real soon.
Oh, thank you.